Hello. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 11th, 1999. In the Koinonia fireside room this evening is Craig Morrison. The session number is 99-1. The session title is Ironies in the Fire, poetry by Craig Morrison. Here it comes.
Ask questions, make comments. Not about the sewer day or about President Clinton, but if you have anything that's relative to creativity or poetry or your own writing, questions about where I get my inspirations or where I do my drawing or writing, please feel free. It encourages spontaneous conversation. Okay, go ahead and start the tape. This is Ironies in the Fire. It's a collection of writings and illustrations dating back to about 1994 on through last week even, or the week before. I update it only because I haven't sent in my copyright yet. I just keep getting a few good poems to put in here. And it's also the name of the CD that I'm going to put out anytime, whichever comes first. I do a lot of poetry that I feel is God inspired. This is an illustration of Paul preaching to the Greeks in the Areopagus, but I use it in the book as my illustration to a poem called All Sizes Fit One, and it's talking about the size of God, and I'll just read it. All sizes fit one. 'Twixt random encounters, I find it odd that people are trying to size up God. They say he's large, why, that's very grand. They say he's obscure, they just don't understand. Not that I'm myself more enlightened, if I ponder too long, I may feel rather frightened. Yet working through self-conscious fear, I'm brightened. By contemplating God, my life may be heightened. He's colossal, prodigious, and vast, transcending enormity through future and past. At times he's tiny, microscopically small, imperceptible, not noticed at all. God is every size at once, altogether, extending in all directions forever. Oh, great. Let me get this straight. Infinitely growing, ever shrinking, keeping my petite brain ever thinking. Creating the concept of space here and now, he's as large or as small as my mind will allow. Yes, contemplation is never done when plumbing God's depths. All sizes fit one. This is, by the time I started drawing in church every Sunday for inspiration and or free time, I realized that I wasn't just drawing pictures and doodling. I was illustrating my book, so I started to not just draw weird little scenes, but the pictures that would go along with my poetry. This is called Prometheus' Predicament, and I'm not too versed in the classics, I'll admit. You know, Homer, Shakespeare, all that. You know, I want to read them, but hey, rather go hiking. So I just imagined, what if Prometheus runs up to the gods, gets the fire, burns the forest down, and he's sitting there, oh, crap. So here's what he might be going through. The fires crackle, spark and spackle, heckling specks of laughter cackle. It shouldn't, it could, the wood is burning. lightly learning in its flashes, slowly turning into ashes, perpetually tasting tongues of fire, torching, scorching its heated desire. It presumed to consume the entire earth, searing flames peer within its girth, flickering, snickering, popping, never stopping. The acrid smoke chokes hickory, oak, as the forest floor flares with combustible air. From blazing to brazen horizon, to smoldering, older and wiser, the coals of his soul burn bright with fright, his gift to mankind everywhere in sight. And slowly growing embers warm November and December, the intense, angry, sanguine glows he knows will be remembered. Does anybody have any questions or comments? I'm trying to encourage lots of that. This is one I did during Bible study fellowship. And where my mind was at, I don't know, but it was worth a good illustration.
It's an exploding drum.
It's a person playing a drum, and the drum is a rocket, and it goes with my percussion poem, my drum circle poem. And this was originally a pastel, which I learned that if I was going to do black and white pen and ink, I should leave the color out, because it kind of copies okay, but it, you know, anyway. Gypsy Jive. The rhythm trickles from the small man's fingers, percolating, scintillating, always lingers while creating. The painted lady dances with a tambourine in hand. She jingles joyously as she moves, barefoot, her toes sift the sand. The barrel-bellied fellow booms the bass with bludgeoning blows. Eyebrows furrow as sweat beads burrow to the roots of the beat that he sows. The calloused man with the calloused hands has ecstatic fire in his eyes. With a toothy grin, he strikes the skin upon which his happiness lies. The ethereal chatter of the talking drum has come to gossip and spout. The wise old woman playing it has nothing to hide as she hits the hide, for she knows what the drum is speaking about. A child in the distance is wild with resistance and curiously drawing near. Always seems like the children are the first to give in to the urge to enjoy what they hear. And the groove is entwined with nature itself, the systems, the cycles, the seasons. Our hearts always beating, repeating, repeating, is as old as rhyme and reason. These are all original size. I haven't manipulated the size at all of the illustrations. I don't know if anybody cares, but I employ a pretty basic style. I like to use real thick lines and patterns and textures, as opposed to intense detail or realistic stuff. That's because I can't, or I don't have the patience to. So that's a tree. This is Douglas the Fir. The tree yawns intensely as another decade passes. Arms outstretched in awe, appreciation in its branches. A year to a tree is the blink of an eye, the epitome of patience without having to try. The contours of its smiling face change subtly in its bark. As another human war is fought and lost, what cost to a world that's in the dark? Its knots are not some missing limbs, but gifts to humanity. Men seek to prune and deplete a resource, yet they spread the love of a tree. It summons the wind to wave its arms in greeting or goodbye. and to get to those hard-to-reach places it raises a hurricane to satisfy. It buries its bare feet under the ground, not to hide or show pride, but to hear the sound of the earth when she speaks, an even older creature. She's slow to react and slower to anger, yet quick to be a teacher. The leaves of a tree always beckon and shout, as we like insects are buzzing about. I must seem like a tree I must seem like a fly to a tree by and by, for we are all in a hurry to live and to die. Oh, we'll stop once a day or a month or a year, remarking of beauty and sounding sincere. But had we a millennia in which to see the comings and goings in the life of a tree, our perceptions of inanimate objects would change, realizing it's we who are so very strange. Mm. Questions, comments, anybody? Got any writers in here? Okay, quiet bunch. This is one of my mom's most hated illustrations of mine. She was my art teacher when I was growing up, and I guess maybe she thinks she wasted her time now. I don't know. No, she supports my art very much. This is the one, I read it at the lift the other night. It's called Nostril Gardening. And all the Narnia kids last week were laughing at my nose hairs, and ha ha, your nose hairs are so long. And so I just wanted to read this one. I like this illustration. It's different. Nostril gardening. Do nose hairs have a mind of their own? Ever there as nostrils flare, casually letting themselves be known, peeking, poking, tickling and waving, curling, unfurling, always misbehaving. Long tenacious weeds from my nasal passage flowing, catching lint and the passing aroma, all the while growing. In number, in length, they have a sense of pride. The olfactory ego's strength just cannot be denied. It boasts it's not a navel hair, and it's glad it's not under the shoulder, or up on the head to turn gray and be dead, and fall off when it's quite a bit older. But the nose hair is happy, contented really, with a finger as a maid. But I shouldn't wait until it's too late to put them in a braid. Nothing? No comments? Boy, I'll have to shock you guys with... Once again, this was a little bit before I realized that it was illustrations for my book. But that was a color design with color crayon. And it's called Textures. Mountains, the teeth of the wreath of God, spiking so striking in an instance I'm awed. In tandem, at random, the towering peaks. At noon, rocks rough-hewn, its shadow sneaks. Such stock pockmarks on God's earthly face, he created, paraded this isolated place. As old as time, they chime his story. The high slopes declare the scope of God's glory. I think I was on a bus when I wrote that. For those of you who think that you have to be in a certain place and feel a certain way to write a poem, although I'd, you know, been at Holden over the summer and had lots of input into me, and it takes a while to chew all that up and process it. This is another one. Actually, I was looking at a dangling leaf. I got really familiar with leaves again. I moved back recently to the house that I grew up in, and it has two gigantic beech nut trees in front. And this leaf was from that tree, and it was the only one that I liked on that fine autumn day, because the other 100,000 were all over the lawn that I got to rake. Which is a nice meditative experience once in your life. This is called dangling. As autumn's wind begins to ebb, the leaf suspended, poised, not dead. It tangled in a spider's web, spinning on a woven thread. Its reddish tint is winter's hint for birds to fly as trees undress, the sun outdone by frosty glint, to return when one can only guess. Oh, autumn, you have life within, as soft rain freshens breezy air. This leaf cannot escape its spin. 'Twill be forever dangling there. I promise some of this stuff is going to be hilarious, because I said so in the announcement. I know, all of a sudden I'm realizing, wait a second, none of this has been hilarious yet. I guess the nose hair one, yeah. This particular poem, it means a lot to me. I read it at the lift the other night, and I don't know. I found Jesus, and Jesus found me, and we have a good relationship. But it's funny that even though I want to become more like Christ every day, there's still a part of me, that old nature that is in the, you know, behind the prison doors, if you will, and he's locked away, but he's still yelling, trying to influence things. Metaphorically speaking, you know, no theology there. This is called The Brig. The prisoner sleeps the night away, terrified. Even asleep, he has something to say, full of pride. He stirs and moans in the deepest hold, getting up, angrily rattling his heavy chains, not letting up. He used to be captain of this ship, so fortified, till the breath of life blew in its sails, he mortified. Wrestling, he was bested by the new creature, forced in the brig, a captive of the good teacher. Yet still can his hollow directives be heard, corruptive, every idle, wayward word disruptive. His vile mocking sends the whole ship wavering, and every sidetracked moment is he savoring. The old nature is not in charge, no question, but not beyond the power of suggestion. Some of these I really could use feedback for. You know, I'm not gonna hold it to you guys, because I know you just came here to hear some poetry, and who's this guy saying you want, you know. This one is an experiment. I certainly wouldn't mind a little feedback on. Being a percussionist and rhythmist, I really do like to experiment with different forms of rhythm. This one, the poem is called Morse, and I don't know Morse code, but I was experimenting, what if a poem was in kind of a Morse code-y kind of feel? So I wrote the poem last year, but I did the illustration, because with the illustration you really kind of know what's going on. So I hope this doesn't, you know, bring anybody down or burst their ship. But anyway, this is called Morse. I guess I should have learned what that little clicking noise meant. All the time it would rat-a-tat like a woodpecker. incessantly clicking. I never listened. Should have paid more attention. Fear, fire, foe. We never did know what that little clicking noise meant. Always did admire the random rhythms. I never thought twice. The bomb found its mark. Smoke, incessant woodpecker, won't save our souls. Click, tick, 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 tock, like a clock, run amok on some ethereal time. No time, sinking fast. Okay, Mom, I'll stop tapping. Stop tapping. Never will stop the tapping. I guess I should have learned what that clicking noise meant.
Nothing.
I knew you were going to say something, so I'll say something.
Please, thank you.
That to me speaks of feelings inside myself about times when I haven't paid attention to God's little messages in my life. And when you don't pay attention to those messages, God tends to make them bigger and louder and stronger for you to hear. Eventually, you feel like your ship has been sunk if you don't pay attention to those messages. And usually that's because God has determined that's what needs to happen in order for you to get the message.
That's really cool. No, that is. Yeah, thank you very much. That new insight. Can I use that? I can just say that that's what it's about. Yeah.
Just a little thank you for what we do.
This is called Marionette. We are like puppets in life, for only when strings are attached are we able to listen to laughter and love as when we are newly hatched. Full of goodwill for his creatures, the grand puppeteer is our master. To resist the direction of his strings would likely lead to disaster. When we marionettes act up on our own, we get tangled in our own cords. We must dance the dance of the puppeteer, for this drama is the Lord's.
I just thought, Craig, that that's a name as well, Marionette.
That you said, because I heard that same thing, even knowing that it wasn't the meaning. It's pretty interesting.
Like a Marie Antoinette.
Oh, that draws us interesting images of things on strings.
It's kind of weird, isn't it? I sort of actually enjoyed the fiery sinking ship. I kind of interpreted it differently, I think.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I know that this one's supposed to be sort of more hopeful, but this one kind of feels trapped and the ship felt freeing. And I liked the code. It reminded me of Laurie Anderson, and it was just kind of funny. And just seemed like a surrender thing more than... I know that one was supposed to be sort of dark, and this is supposed to be sort of hopeful, but it's dark to me.
And that's great, you know, perspectives. Someone might look at that and that's perfect.
I think that the poetry in anything is how it speaks to you. What's going on inside you, anything that elicits in you some emotional response, anything that awakens something inside of you, to me that's the essence of poetry. And it can be looking at the mountain, or it can be somebody's words, or it can be a song. But that to me is
Do you mean for that to be a hopeful? I don't see that
Okay. But yeah, I did.
It seems that it's under, to me, it's very predetermined. And it lacks freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks angry besides. He doesn't look happy.
Yeah, and that I do want to say one thing about the illustrations is I do it in pen. I don't say, well, I like this and this about it. Let me do it over. And up till now, it's like the one shot. And if I make a mistake, I turn it into something, you know, turn it into something different. And I kind of have enjoyed that style. So sometimes, yeah, this guy, I've had different comments on this guy. And he doesn't really, he looks like a puppet, you know. Pardon me?
What mood were you in when you
penned it? I don't know. It gives me a positive feeling. It seems like a new baby or a baby bird that just hatches, and it's kind of shaky and wobbly and doesn't really know how to act. And the poem is about God's direction, kind of showing the newly hatched puppet, you know, how to do the dance. And it's interesting to me because when I do, you know, if I dance along with, you know, if I'm speaking within the poem, if I dance along with the puppeteer with God's direction, it's a very beautiful dance, and I really couldn't add to it. And if I tried to, it just kind of like, you know, and all the strings get tangled and it doesn't seem very pretty at all anymore. And then I have to say, help, you know, untangle me. But I've totally respect and appreciate the perspectives. If this gives you a kind of a weird vibe or a, you know, oppressive, that's great.
Kind of the beauty of all this, like you say, because it's a real interesting paradox between a new birth and yet the person that comes out looks full grown.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I bring my own vision out of my age to this. Mm-hmm. I think if that's a factor, whether I'm, you know, 18 or 30 or 50 in that too. So what I like about it is that I can project so much stuff in it. You know, and it is a nice projective medium for where I am or where I'm not.
Uh-huh. Neat. Neat. You guys are gonna love these ones though.
You're gonna have a lot of people that you're gonna have to give credit to in your book.
This is an illustration that really kind of does stand out on its own. And I just kind of said, oh, it goes with that poem. That's great. But, so, it's some of them, most of them, I take the poem and I draw the illustration to it. This illustration just kind of came out, and the poem, even though it had been written, I said, oh, that poem fits it. So here it is. It's called Growth Spurt. The flower of youth, so elusive, on the surface a great decoy, holds the glitter of truth that's exclusive, for youth's really measured in joy. When I was a child, I thought as a child, I spoke as a child, I smoked as a child. But then I became a man and put away all childish things. I eagerly sought to grow up, embracing the hardness of heart that it brings. Now I've become a child again by letting adulthood go. The inner child is loving and thankful, and joy makes the countenance glow. This transformation we all must endure. Life stages we find will refine and make pure. The age of the body is irrelevant. What counts is the age of the soul. Most find youth at the end of their lives, if ever they reach their goal. So if anyone tries convincing me that youth's really measured in years, they're likely trying to prove to themselves to wallow amidst some fears.
I'm interested in stool. Are those little eyes looking up on the stool?
From the footstool?
Yeah.
Yes. What this illustration started out as, it's for another poem of mine called Hide and Seek. And that there's all these different things that poetry is hiding under it. And I was going to put all these things in there with eyes kind of poking out. Uh-huh. And I had this and I thought, no, this is too cool. I like it the way it is. It's not going to be for that poem. And if I was smart, I'd probably write a poem about, you know, the generationlessness of dreams or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just like it. Although, artist, critic, I think the guy's feet are a little too small, but anyway. The time machine. Tranquil humming, grinding purr, mundane routines that reoccur, marching into ages hence, from the past that could not give defense. The time machine borrows from yesterday, sorrows from tomorrow since passed away. Its face stares out from time unknown, the ageless ticking of an endless drone. Arms incessant, revolving around, its circumference never quite touching the ground. It tells of the beast that devours all things, vast appetite and never-ending strings. The time machine's winters and springs and gears reflect the moonlight of countless years. Now and again it is filled with alarm, clutching the hours with its short arm. Numerals of Rome are inscribed on its face as it travels forever, not moving through space. The chimes ring on wood and metals, pendulum swinging, the dust never settles. Speaking volumes without having to talk, the time machine, antique grandfather clock. What fun. Wish I had a grandfather clock. This is the one I said earlier that, I don't know if you guys were at dinner, but I was talking about the circus poem and that sometimes the illustration made it a little bit more lively in people's minds. Felt under the big top. The sturdy hurdy-gurdy's revolutions add confusion to the organ grinder's grinding, winding ever on and on. The monkey is his flunky, with a cymbal in each very nimble hand on which it stands, clanging ceaseless thereupon. The flowing cotton candy's knowing time is near to disappear, a muscle wet and pink helps its hopes of life to sink. With resolve, it dissolves down the sticky smile of a riled child reconciled to fun. The clowns, they dance around, prance the grounds and making faces, taking roses from their vases, juggling noses in the sun. The bearded lady's shady stubble sprouting on the double earns her ticket and right to picket the barber who harbors no trouble. The quilted men on stilts are built beside the gilded ride, right outside the roller coaster, just above the hot dog roaster, energetic weenie boaster, tipsy toaster full of pride. May the circus never work us after laughter leaves the big top, and the feeling that we capture be be a rapture, undenied. Did people, there's still a lot of images in people's minds. I don't know if that, did you guys get that? Or,
yeah.
Okay, I want to know, because it's, this one, it's one of those ones that dates back to like about 94, except I kind of edited it. I used to do a lot of poetry slams, got slammed and then realized that it was a sham, a poetry sham. And did stuff for sensational purposes and had to learn the hard way that poetry is just about inspiration. This one's called Taxi. The taxi driver, courageous conniver, is a weary cadaver behind the steering wheel, smoking the butt of a Camel. Nervous, trembling fingers shove it down deep into an overflowing ashtray. He pulls up to the curb. He's somewhat disturbed and filled with apprehension, wondering where the next journey might take him. The back door opens and a figure crawls inside. A glance in the rearview mirror tells him nothing. All he can see are the whites of his eyes. This troubles him just a little bit, for he wishes to label this figure into one of his three sects: yuppies, junkies, and freaks. He likes the yuppies, they tip him quite well, and the junkies, they rob him, he'll see them in hell. It's the freaks that he simply cannot figure out, for he never knows what they are about. Without regret, he sparks a cigarette, and in the little bit of butane light, he sees his apprehension was right. A freak! He knew this day would come. He and his first 2 weeks never talk to the freaks, just play fair with the fares, and by all means, never take a freak anywhere. So every time that the freak speaks his peace, ranting of unceased of Jesus deceased, and alive to the earth and of second birth, the driver shrinks and thinks back to the words that he heard on his training, remaining so cool. He's no fool. He just stares at the hair of the freak, speaking the language of love, yet loving no one. The freak takes the hint and hands over a five and jumps out of the car, and the cabbie gets far as he can from the man. But a few miles back, I stand by the road, a freak feeling pity for the driver's load. To bear it, not share it, I'd swear it corrupt. Every hole in his desperate soul would erupt. Still driving, conniving the weary cadaver, forever so clever behind his steering wheel. And I did spend a couple years in Florida, or in Miami, for any people that are wondering. So I've seen a Miami taxi driver, and they are something, they're a breed of their own.
Worse than New York?
Huh?
Worse than New York?
Well, I've never been to New York, so I don't know. Nobody likes this illustration, but I don't care.
She
likes all the weird ones. The bombs and boats going down in flames.
Didn't you say this is all irony?
Yeah. This is called Solarium. The twilight through the skylight, iron pyrite, hues of gold, sends brilliant and resilient beams of color, blithe and bold. The room in flower, illumined shower, a powerful sparkled glaze, humidifies the mist which glistens pristine in the haze. The window sweats and knows no threats of darkness all pervading. It reflects the insects and directs the light from fading. The butterfly, it mutters why and hears no uttered cry, for it lacks ears, as it appears, to gaze upon the sky. The greenhouse, so serene house, home of growth and warmth and cheer. As dewdrops shine from a cactus spine, I find the divine quite near. And the reason no one likes that is because they think that, well, my dad looked at that and said, it looks like the guy's head is going to pop off and he's all worried about it or something. So, I don't know. Huh?
Are these all your own poems?
Yeah, these are all my own poems, and
wow.
Yeah, I have fun with it. The illustrations I do while I'm in church, listening to the pastor preach. although this is more about. Actually, I drew this illustration when I was visiting my parents' church. I go to one in the ghetto, which is more of my style. But this one, it's just the parents' church. The guy that preaches is right on, but the whole thing, there's like video projectors that put the words that the pastor's going to say before he even can say them, and like some kind of prophecy or something. And it just kind of, you know, turned me off a little bit, but this poem has nothing to do with that. It's just kind of one of those that I put the poem along with the illustration. It's called Tall Wall of Tales. Talking about living, my favorite thing to do, but from a safe distance from experience's view. Talking about living, yet not living at all, it's my imagination. There's no tale too tall. Talking about living, from behind a door, as long as it's closed, I'm safe and secure. Talking about living, but it's only talk. I get where I need to without having to walk. Talking about living, but I'm fantasizing the future and past, just romanticizing. Talking about living, and how sweet it is to see the other guy's journey, as long as it's his. Talking about living, but only to a measure, avoiding all the pain, but missing out on pleasure. Talking about living, yet never risking much, wrapped up in security, such shall be the crutch. Talking about living from the umbrella of routine, never getting rained on and never getting clean. Talking about living from underneath my mask, this world of speculation is such an easy task. Talking about living, but I've got nothing to say, because since all I did was talk about living today.
I like that one.
Well, thank you. Thank you. All the questions and comments, I can handle them, so please.
I'm a great advocate of burning your television, by the way.
Okay. Okay.
I like my TV.
I'm gonna do. There's a couple illustrations that go with this one.
I have a question. What was the fire about anyway?
Well, for this illustration, when I was drawing it, I pictured someone putting a TV on an altar, and you know, burnt offering. And while the burnt offering's going on, there's some preacher, televangelist guy going, hey, how you doing? It's a gospel hour. So
your description.
That's my burnt offering, you know. But it's not really a sacrifice because I never watched it anyway. Anyway, this is, I'm probably going to read it at Renaissance Day, but hey, you guys get a sneak preview. Long, long ago, it's called Song Soup. Long, long ago, too long now to recall, when our history was future, or recorded not at all, there lived a bright young minstrel, a joyous, gleeful breed. Only harmony and music did he forever need. He had a heart of praise for the creator of his song, yet to please anyone but oneself was looked upon as wrong. In a land where every person's instrument was sharing, no one played together, ever blaring, never caring. The chaos and the din, it could be heard for miles around. Discordant solos all day long in the minstrel's own hometown. Each and every day he attempted to set free guided song and sensitivity. At the end of every evening, his frustration would abound. He felt he had to leave that place to seek some fallow ground. The next day, he began his orchestrative quest to seek some souls to play with, or die you're being blessed. Though through several inharmonious towns, he traveled many miles to reach the border of his land and leave the ignorant smiles. After many ponderous days, the gleeful minstrel found a place not only missing harmony, but devoid of musical sound. The first town that he entered was small and quaint and fair. He quickly found the marketplace and settled in the square. The town observed the minstrel and thought him strange and queer. They approached him slow and timidly, overcoming fear. They said, "You are a minstrel, and it makes our hearts thus sad, for it's been ages since we played the instruments that we had." "Not to worry," said the minstrel, dancing about with joy. "I'll just play my flute. You clap your hands now, little boy. You bang these stones together. You, sir, ring the bell. Now, if we only had a bass drum." "Ah, it's just as well." "I've got a laundry barrel," the merchant then replied, and as he ran to fetch it, the minstrel simply sighed. "A drum will make it lovely, but I'm feeling very torn, for I feel it would be 10 times better if we only had a horn." At this point, I'm going to change the illustrations for a minute so you guys can see the rest of it. In a book, this would be, you know, on either side of the page. The hunter said, "I've got one, and I remember how to play. Though it's been ages since I carved it, thought I'd never see the day." "Wonderful," said the minstrel, waving around his hands. "Still, it'd be complete with cymbals. Let's try pots and pans." The farmer cried, "I'll get some," and headed for his place. "And I'll bring a surprise I invented. I call it a washtub bass." "Marvelous," exclaimed the minstrel. "What pleasure your good nature brings. Should I not even bother to ask if you might actually have some strings?" "I've an old harp," said the seamstress, "made from my mother's hair." "Splendid indeed," said the minstrel. "The heirloom will add to the flair." As the people brought their instruments, he said, "We're nearly ready. The rest of you sing loudly to keep us true and steady." As he placed his flute to his lips and blew a beautiful tone, the townsfolk began to play together, such a miracle he'd never known. The drums beat together in unison, and the issuing cry of the horn intertwined all of the chorus as harmony in music was born. The cymbals crashed emphatically. The man with the bell was ringing. Even the boy who was clapping his hands was smiling as he was singing. The minstrel rejoiced ecstatically as the harp chimed to meet the bass. His flute blew a blissful echo as a tear made its way down his face. The townsfolk played long and merrily, many hours into the eve. They praised the creator of music and his minstrel, who now had to leave. "Musicians and friends," said the minstrel, "I'm sorry I have to depart, but I must spread this song to your countrymen with the joy that is in my heart. I hope you will all play together and listen with careful ears. Let harmony be your guidance. Today is on down through the years." The minstrel left town that evening, the song welling up in his soul. He gave to each town that he came to, as was his orchestrated role. I'll put the other one on real quick just to... They all look so happy.
Oh.
Anybody have any questions?
When do you plan to publish?
I don't know. I keep hoping that someone will come along and do it for me so I don't have to be rejected a lot. Or I'll make a CD. But a lot of it, you know, I've worked with kids before, and I appreciate the childlike perspective. It's fun for me to do something that I mean, I don't know. Did you guys like that?
Yeah.
Okay. I hope a kid would enjoy some of it. some of it, like this one, is not really... Well, you kids pay attention, because the ironies of alcohol can do this to anyone. This is called I'll Drink to That, and this is also inspired by the same roommate that I wrote that poem, Hell with All Respects to Dante, about. I'll drink to that. The chalice parts the fool's lips. He sips while soul is closed. A token remembrance of 10,000 trips to the cellar for drunken repose. Nostalgia taps him on the head like an ice pick on top of a mountain. His elbow elevates to up the cup. He's engulfed in a frothy fountain. His synapses explode, then take a vacation. He enjoys his brain on recreation. He walks the flat line of the body entire, awaiting sunrise with its pain and fire. But for now, should the chance to get drunk come along, he will host every toast and join any song. Alcoholic, he's addicted, tripped up victim, so they say. His bloodshot eyes read no surprise unless it's taken away. A wise man will make a mistake once and learn, but the fool repeats them at every turn. Ladies and gentlemen, the views expressed by the author is not the expressed views of Holden Village. I wasn't planning on doing every single poem tonight. How many of you guys were actually at the lift the other night? Noel. Well, bear with me. This is the illustration that goes along with my special Valentine's Day poem. Okay. It says self-conscious, and the other guy's mirror says vain. This is, Well, Valentine's Day, the concept is great, but the marketing is what gets me. All the hearts and fluffs and farty tarts and... Anyway, this is called Valentwined. This crazy day, obsessed with passion, culture like a vulture preys on helpless ones entranced with fashion. Youthful lusts last only days. Pink flowers, stinky shower lotion. Not too late to find a date. Stirring, blurring of emotion. Hurry, pick you up at 8. Sugar candies, chocolate hearts, commercial rush on initial crush. Cause more harm than good, those tarts, to which end leaves no teeth to brush. And sweetheart, be mine is sure to be heard, as romantic antics abound for the day. It's weird how the rest of the year it's deferred. The essence it lessens, then fades away. A costly tribute to infatuation, as supple couples co-depend. This glamorous, amorous flatulation, I'm waiting for this day to end. And so flirtation is but fleeting. True love lasts a life or longer. Patient, kind, and interceding, ever flowing, growing stronger.
We have to go, but thank you.
Oh, sure. Anybody have any questions? Like, why do you sound like such a jaded, bitter person? I proposed to my future wife a couple weeks after I wrote that poem. But I was learning about the marketing gets me.
Yeah,
you know?
I think it sounded that like cool because you wrote how true love lasts longer, and you're just saying that how like people are search for a date just because they don't want to be alone because Hallmark made up the Valentine's Day
gross the market. Yeah, exactly.
Like on Valentine's Day, I have more fun when I hang out with my girlfriends and we go out to eat and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's cool. So I'm not the only one out there, huh?
Yeah.
Right on.
Did you get you a Valentine's Day present?
He's sent me that poem in the mail.
Before or after you said yes?
No, that was before you proposed.
Oh, wow.
This is a... I think I'll do a couple more, and then we'll call it an evening. I have no idea what time it is, so I'm just kind of...
It's about 9:40.
Yeah, this is a... Maybe I'll end it on a good note. Oh, actually, this is another one. And this is actually Hide and Seek, the one that I started writing, the one with the eyes on the little footstool for. And it just, I don't know, sometimes I don't know what the heck I'm drawing, and it just kind of... Bleh. And it may not end up in the book, but it's hide and seek, and there it is. There's poetry hiding in the slumbery confines of counterpane as I manufacture dreams, seems too fleeting to grasp. In the slithery skin of a scaly snake as it frigidly finds food, the mood of poetry's just out of reach on a weary grandfather's semi-intoxicated grin as he laughs at nothing at all. It calls in the acrid smell of wood smoke around a boisterous bonfire, or desiring the soft touch of velvet on smooth skin. Within the poetry, concealed in the aha feeling of sudden inspiration, is celebration of jubilation. Its creation lurks under the glowing green canopy of a willow tree on a sunny day. It may well be in the ominous maraca chorus of cicadas on a humid summer night. Each bite it waits in the taste of clover honey sticking to a windpipe. Ripe poetry hangs from the orchard with the torture of not being plucked. It's tucked, hiding inside the tip of a pen as creativity leaks onto a page, leaving indelible marks. That was, you may have noticed certain, I experiment sometimes, you know, like, that was, it just ended up where the last kind of, I picked a word from the last part of each phrase and rhymed it with the first part of the word from the next phrase. And it's fun. If I could find... Funhouse.
Now, why do you do these drawings in church?
That's the only time I get any free time.
Oh. Okay.
Like, you know, I'm still listening, don't get me wrong.
Oh.
I still love to,
I thought still... you were bored or something.
No.
I see.
It's just everybody's got their heads down writing anyway. They're all writing, taking notes. And I don't like to take notes. So, as might as well...
Notes.
Huh?
You might as well just look like you're taking notes.
Yeah, but actually, I stopped drawing for a couple of years because I thought I was distracting people. And kids were always looking over my shoulder and stuff. Then I realized I'm not drawing anything. I need to start doing art again. So, just about October, November, I started drawing again.
Sense it is kind of taking notes.
Yeah, no, it's not. I'm not gonna
pictures.
I'm not
instead
gonna
of words, you know.
Yeah, but it's not really anything about. Okay.
Yeah,
okay,
I was
sure.
Trying to let you off the hook. Embarrassing.
Well, I don't know. I don't mind doing two things at once. I think I can learn and glean from a church service and also draw an illustration or. Some art.
There's places of inspiration in our lives. Might be while you're driving the car somewhere.
Yeah, that's dangerous.
I come up with my best lesson plan ideas while I'm driving. So.
This, I did read it before, but maybe people were in the pizza line and I like the illustration. This is Funhouse. This is one of my older poems. Woke up one morning in bed in 1994, early January, and just had this crazy line in my head. Laughter in the rafters. What the heck is all that? And this poem just came out
blip. And I didn't get out of bed until I finished it.
Mm-hmm.
And an hour later, I had this. The illustration came just this year. It's called Funhouse. There's laughter in the rafters, afterthoughts are on the roof. Today window panes will feel no pain, the shutters feeling so aloof. The chimney's smoking busily, rolling its own in a doleful way. The skeletons are in the closet, for in the darkness they must stay. The bathroom's constipated, resigning itself to X-Lax duels, while the wall safe is in trouble, having misplaced the family jewels. The front door is in open arms, yet arming itself with high-tech alarms. The study is pondering, its visions wandering, while the vanity's flaunting its self-proclaimed charms. The carpet feels it's walked upon, riddled with self-conscious doubt, while the bedroom isn't making love, so it lustfully feels left out. The kitchen is cooking impatiently, watching a pot that will never boil. And the garage undertakes another fix-it project, hoping the neighbors will notice its toil. The television rattles on attention it demands, while the couch is growing a patch of potatoes with cultivating hands. The basement's clutter just makes it mutter, forgotten abysmally, while the furnace is sweating, forever dreading being turned up constantly. The manic depressive stairway, not knowing whether it's up or down. And as if it had nothing else to do, the chandelier just hangs around. The lawn is dying of thirst, crying out for the garden hose, but the hose is coiled comfortably, lethargically in a doze. All in all, a happy place. It begs no pleas or pardons, yet not exactly the type of house for better homes and gardens.
Yay.
If anybody has any questions or anything, now's your chance to. No pressure. Yeah, thanks for coming tonight, guys.